Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Swarm.
Welcome to The Swarm, everyone.
This is our second to last episode of 2018.
It's kind of nuts. It's gone by really fast, I feel like, James.
Yeah, it's been great. We've been really humbled about all the great feedback we've gotten. We've had some really great guests, and we've really enjoyed ourselves.
All right, and for this second to last episode, James and I really thought, you know, we couldn't go the whole season really without talking about Louisiana's coastline.
Very important here. So being a native of New Orleans and southern Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, we are very much impacted by the climate and the coastal erosion and the water that has infiltrated our lives. And we, as architects, use that to our advantage to design around. And it's something we have to consider when we do design things.
So with that being said, I would like to introduce Liz Williams-Russell. She is now the Coastal Community Resilience Director for the Foundation for Louisiana. And we'll be talking all things coast.
If you're from the Gulf South, if you're from New Orleans, if you're interested in this, if you're interested in climate change, coastal erosion, this is going to be a great episode for you. She's a very interesting person. She's very captivating, and she's very passionate about what she does.
Here she is.
Hi, everyone. I'm James.
And I am Seamus, and you are listening to The Swarm, a podcast about architecture and design.
We're two architects at the firm Cicada here in New Orleans.
The Swarm is an outlet that brings the world of architecture to the people.
Our goal is to educate our listeners about design and construction by interviewing locals who are making an impact on their community.
All right, everybody. We have Liz Williams-Russell on the show today. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
We're super excited to have you on. Being from I guess before I get onto
you guys know each other.
We do. So quick background: Liz and I do know one another. We both went to LSU Architecture School together, and from there, kind of took different professional paths, which has actually been extremely interesting because I've stayed on more of the traditional architectural path, whereas Liz has kind of been behind the scenes in saving our earth path.
Saving Louisiana.
That's so huge.
Thank you.
Whoa.
Yeah, we're here trying to do this, and you're saving the world.
It's definitely not a one-person task, so don't put too much.
But
Captain Planet over here.
All goofiness aside, we're extremely happy to have you on. Liz Russell is, her actual title is, she works for the Foundation for Louisiana, and she is the Coastal Community Resilience Director. I'm going to leave it at that. Liz, I'm going to kind of let you tell our audience who you work for and if you could briefly summarize what you do.
Sure. I will attempt to do that. So I manage our coastal and climate portfolio, essentially. The Foundation for Louisiana was actually started 5 days after Hurricane Katrina, meant to be a philanthropic intermediary that could pull in diverse funding from all sorts of donors, the country of Japan, the Bush Clinton Katrina Fund,
oh, wow.
Text this number kind of thing.
So your company was founded literally after Katrina.
Right after Katrina.
Crazy. Okay.
We are essentially a statewide social justice organization.
Okay. So you do quite a variety of things.
We have portfolios in the criminal justice space, in racial healing and justice, in housing. We provide grant support to lots of community-based partners that really don't identify as any single issue area. Mm-hmm. But again, I manage our coastal and climate portfolio. And the Coastal Resilience Leverage Fund was established back at the end of 2015, and I came on not long after.
Can you give me an example of how our audience may kind of understand where you guys come into play if something were to happen, I guess, to their community or something like that?
So a lot of the work that we do is not just in the days after an event. However, obviously, mm-hmm. when there is an event, there's usually an influx of cash that needs to get down to partners on the ground. But we are always sort of working behind the scenes to cultivate the work so that we're not always responding to a single event.
Mm-hmm.
So in the coastal space, that means working with community partners in various coastal communities or in the city of New Orleans, who, again, don't really identify as just coastal or just environmental, but they really see the intersection of issues of water, issues of flood risk impacting their everyday lives in a more regular way, that whether that has to do with job access or getting your kids to school or the types of housing and insurability that you have access to. And then if there is a disaster, we are sort of prepared to take in donations and then move rapid response funds out to organizations. I should also mention we have partners that range from those intimate local level partners mm-hmm. all the way up to sort of state allies and national and global allies in some cases. So we work with regional NGOs, for regional nonprofits. We work with local community-based partners who maybe work in a single parish and then others who work across six parishes, as well as we've worked with government partners, whether that's the city of New Orleans or the state of Louisiana.
So you manage the Coastal Resilience Leverage Fund.
Yes.
And how did you get to that position?
Yeah, so that's kind of a long one. So Hurricane Katrina hit while I was in architecture school. And a lot of the baggage that I carried was sort of buried by the system of checklists and sort of classes and courses that was our traditional architectural education. I, in 2010, moved overseas and moved to London to accidentally really begin pulling apart some of that. So I was lucky enough to go to the Bartlett School of Architecture for my master's, and they really provided the flexibility for you to, you know, do whatever you want as long as you do it well and make sort of beautiful work.
Your master's thesis, what was that about?
So I basically spent a year exploring the Mississippi River. At the time, I would have told you that I was looking at the Mississippi River as a way of looking at American culture. Frankly, it's a history of political and economic conditions influencing how we construct our infrastructure. And so I really had the privilege of pulling apart some of that. At the time, you know, I had to work on a thesis, but I also was creating huge images after images. In England, they're A1 drawings, which is like 24 by 33 inches, and I, you know, tens and tens of them. And I feel really lucky to have been given the flexibility to explore that, because frankly, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now without that.
Right. It's interesting how like your path through education, whether you know it or not at the time, it's certainly influencing clearly where you're going to be within the next couple of years.
Yeah, so I had tried to return to traditional architecture practice after finishing my master's, and I also had been given the opportunity to begin teaching first-year architecture at a university outside of London. And so part of the week I was sort of working there, and part of the week I was working in the firm. And frankly, it was at the height of the economic downturn. Mm. I felt very lucky to even have a job. My former colleagues from my master's in extraordinary school of architecture were having lots of trouble getting any sort of bites on their portfolios. And after a couple of months there, there was a prospect of me sort of working with a number of unpaid interns and helping to manage them that were frankly selected by their proximity to the office because legally you have to pay for their travel.
Oh, interesting.
So I quit very suddenly and went straight to a pub where I had been regular and asked if I could have a job.
Nice.
Was that the pub where you met the gentleman from Sierra Nevada?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, what? I don't know this story.
Liz has actually met the
Steve Grossman.
Was he the brewmaster or the owner?
One of the owners, one of the founders.
Side note.
The Grossman brothers worked on this together, but luckily I didn't do any trash talking about his beer because I was quite frank with people.
He didn't reveal it right away.
He did not. Yeah. So I was quite used to having customers be like, so what's good, you know? And I was like, this is crap. Don't get that. You know, try this out. And luckily I had not said anything bad about his beer. And I recognized an American accent. So I said, you know, where are you from in the States? And he said, I'm from Northern California. I said, oh, cool. Where, you know? He's like, Chico. And not too many folks live in Chico, right? So it eventually came out. And then I had the amazing experience of being able to travel with him and his distributor around London.
That's
for
insane.
The next few days.
Man,
and go to breweries and restaurants. It was ridiculous and a blast.
The chances of that are very slim.
Yeah, totally, totally.
And that's actually why she does what she does now, after meeting the owner of Sierra Nevada.
No, so I quit my job. I started working at this pub. The pub gave me the flexibility to kind of continue doing some of the research I was doing, but also within a few months, I had two more teaching jobs. And so I was hired at the University of Greenwich in addition to Birmingham, and then had a side gig at the University of Nottingham. And anyway, so I was doing all this research for actually some years about Louisiana from London. And you know, I will say there's so much value sometimes in being able to get a little bit of distance from the intensity of the environment that you care so much about.
Halfway across the world.
Absolutely. But in England, there's no summer school, right? There's no summer courses. So each summer I would return to the States to work. So in 2012, I was working in New York. My job from London supported me to go there. And then in 2013, I came back to the States to work at the Coastal Sustainability Studio.
Got it.
At LSU.
At LSU.
Yeah.
And so that was a clear how you are where you are now, right? I mean,
Yeah, kind of. So I was just there for a few months. Yeah. My boss at the time said, you know, Liz, civil engineers are over there, architects, landscape architects, coastal scientists. You know, we work with these social scientists or economic advisors, legal team. Get to know everybody, all the projects everyone's working on. Come up with a design project where everyone can be involved.
Love it.
And then we're submitting that to these folks in New York who you may know.
Wait, now that you're telling me this, though, like that's summer. Literally, I mean, you're managing all of this talent.
It's really scary.
It is, but you're put immediately in a management role that you're managing all of this talent of people in extremely different disciplines and backgrounds, yet are all brilliant in their own ways.
Totally.
And with all the same interests.
I have to be honest, I thought I was going to come back and like live with my brother for the summer and just like have beers on the porch and relax. It was not that.
Which is a typical Louisiana summer.
Right, typical summer. But I will say, you know, the differences in language for those folks, right?
Oh,
you're using
for sure.
the same vocabulary. Right. And I'm not talking about terms like resilience or sustainability or equity that kind of everybody has this amorphous amoeba-like definition of, but things such as land, right? What is land and how is it defined? It was so fascinating. Like I learned very quickly that having an all-staff meeting all the time was not productive at all. Because we would get into these tangential field-wide debates about, you know, do you define land by being able to float, you know, if you can float a toothpick on the water above the surface of the land,
is it land anymore? So now I want to know, like, okay, now I'm thinking, like, how do you define it? Is it, what is marsh? What is land? What is, you know, a stick of reeds? What is an alligator? Like, can you stand, if you can stand on an alligator, is it land?
Stand on it, like, what's an oil?
So how do you define it? This is good.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And honestly, in Louisiana, everything is mush, right? Everything is mush. But it's gradients of mush.
That's a good one.
And the sort of clay soils.
That's going to be our title, by the way. Everything is hashtag everything is mush.
Everything is mush. I'm getting that bumper sticker.
But the clay soils that we have here in New Orleans and across the Mississippi Delta are actually one of the reasons, compared to somewhere like Miami, that we can combat sea level rise, right? All of southern Louisiana, most of it at least, was built by the Mississippi River over thousands of years of deposition, right? And if you think about, if you bake a cake and you're baking a layer cake, the Mississippi River used to flood and it was like every year put a new layer on that cake,
right?
So the highest grounds are actually closest to the former distributaries of the river system.
So all of you in New Orleans, everybody on Chapatoulas, congratulations.
Yeah.
You're very high.
But also the Gentilly Ridge and the Metairie Ridge, right? There's a ridge that goes straight south out of Oswego.
What's the best ridge?
I feel like that's an arguable question.
Well, you're the smartest person in the room, so.
I'm not sure what the best ridge is. I feel like, you know, the Mississippi River likely would have changed course by about 1950 if we weren't keeping it exactly where it is right now. So after there was a huge flood in 1927. And if anybody wants to read more about this, there's a book called Rising Tide. After 1927, which like huge swaths of land, and I'm sorry, I don't know the actual acreage and square miles, but across a sort of, I want to say 8 to 10 state area were flooded. So at a federal level, and differently from now, I think there was a more national recognition that the river was important to everyone.
Got
right?
It.
I think now we've like, we've kind of disconnected from the industry that is supplied on the river.
I agree with that. So
you don't have people in Ohio thinking about the levees in New Orleans as related to them. Or forget Ohio, you know, Colorado. At that time, you had people across the country lobbying for these federal decisions about water management.
Interesting.
Many, many states away. And so now we're at this place where we made this decision after the flood of 1927 to levee off the river and to restrict where the river could go so that we could support economic growth and the growth of communities. Right. And so now in Louisiana in particular, because that levying off the river has meant that we have reduced that freshwater and sediment that used to go into our basins every spring, that has meant the collapse of the delta. There's actually a National Geographic article from 1897 that says, you know, for three or four generations, it's going to be perfect that we levied off the river. But by that fourth generation, the delta will be collapsing. But by that point, surely the entire country will recognize the value and have no problem putting in money to rectify that situation.
I have a question. So I have my very limited understanding of this. So you levy up the river and that restricts the river from overflowing and pushing the sediment into the delta plains and into all those areas.
More importantly, into people's homes and businesses.
Right. So you're preventing that from happening, which is a good thing temporarily because then everyone sinks. But does all the sediment still go down the river and shoot out the delta?
Straight off the continental shelf.
So it's just shooting off the shelf. So it's just sinking into the abyss.
So the Mississippi River has kind of lengthened itself as far as it can go at this point. The Bird's Foot Delta, which is at the end of Plaquemines Parish, the sort of edge of Louisiana, it sort of has met the continental shelf. So all of that sediment is wasted. I will say, you know, indigenous people used to have no problem with these floods. You know, they used to move amongst them. They built mounds. They had more sort of temporary inhabitation when the river was where it was. And it has only been since sort of European colonization that we have made these decisions to levy off the system.
Right. So we went from this temporary lifestyle to now a very permanent lifestyle.
Right. That doesn't know how to deal with water.
Which has consequence. But I mean, clearly we're all making decisions, I suppose, at the time that are in favor of what we're trying to do, right? We're making what we think are good decisions, but there's always consequences.
Given right. what we know. Yeah. I will say the state of Louisiana, the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, which is an agency that was established after Hurricane Katrina and is the restoration body. It's sort of the management of any investments to restore the coast or reduce flood risk in coastal communities. The CPRA has projects called river diversions, which essentially would cut a controlled hole in the levees, and maybe a controlled canal, if you will, to allow for that freshwater and sediment to go back into those basins.
Wait, does this happen now?
No, so they're working on them.
Okay, so this could happen.
So they're moving forward. So they're controversial because the fishing industry has gotten quite used to where the salinity has moved inland. So as saltwater has come closer, that has meant that shrimp are caught closer and certain oyster leases are more profitable than maybe they were previously. And so the state is really trying to come to terms with now, how do we resolve some of those challenges for commercial fishing, given we have the largest commercial fishery in the lower 48 states. So it's really important that we solve this. But how do we find a balance, right, with restoring?
So people are getting comfortable based on where it is the river is now.
You know, for the shrimpers, the shrimp aren't leaving. They're going to be in different places, right? So how there could be questions asked for those shrimpers that want to remain in the industry. You know, how can we support you in a loan of $50,000 to scale up your boat or get a different refrigeration system, right? So for me, this becomes a question again of bringing community into the conversation. And actually hearing from those people who are most impacted and closest to the repercussions, how can we help you and what would that look like? And I'm not saying that that's the end all be all, but how do we problem solve together and fix this barrier?
So Could you give us an example of that? So if you're part of this organization and you go to a community, like what's an example of something that you would engage the community about?
So a lot of the work we do is much bigger than just this set of diversion challenges. We are in the housing space. We're in the economic development space. We're in the public health space. So I would say one of the barriers to coastal land loss and flood risk and restoration, frankly, being a major issue that all Louisianans can get behind. I mean, generally people are into it, but it's not like, you know, this is my thing, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it's seen as only environmental generally.
Right.
And
you're saying it's not.
It's not. It has repercussions and ripple effects across everything we care about. So back in 2015, we had a grant from the, I'm sorry, 2016 was when we actually started the work, grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to work with Plaquemines Parish to design a planning process that actually would bring them to the table from day one. What would that look like? And some of those questions are logistical. How many meetings do we have? At what scale? You know, what barriers do we need to solve for? Childcare, transportation, food? How do we have these very difficult conversations with folks, but also, you know, how do we solve for literacy rates and language barriers and the technical nature of flood risk information for the average Louisianan, which in some cases at about a fifth grade or eighth grade reading level. Wow. In 2017, we actually worked to implement this planning process with the state of Louisiana. So we decided to co-fund and co-manage between the Foundation for Louisiana and the state's Office of Community Development that planning process as a project called LA Safe, Louisiana Strategic Adaptations for Future Environments. And if anybody wants to learn more, lasafe.la.gov is the website. Between March and December of last year, we had 71 community planning meetings.
A question about these meetings and just engaging just people in general. It must be difficult for you to go up to someone and say, look, you know, these things will impact you and generations, and these scales could be thousands of years. How do you get people to think beyond like lunch and dinner, like what Seamus said, like just getting beyond that level for people to be involved? It must be difficult.
I think that's the right question. So I like to compare it to trying to think about your retirement strategy when you can't pay rent tomorrow. Nice. It's just not happening, right?
Yeah.
So, but that being said, coastal communities know this is happening already. You're not bringing them new information. And frankly, it's problematic for any expert to feel like they are. Bringing them new information. And people have personal experiences of these changes, and they can talk to you about how they show up. They just haven't usually been given the chance to do that.
Got it.
Nice.
And I'm sure you come across people who are also probably stubborn because they have lived in that their whole lives. So it's like, I know how to deal with this thing kind of deal. I mean, do you ever come across that?
So when we talk about some of the, I would say, scariest aspects of sea level rise and land loss, you know, we were told before we went into these meetings that we were going to have our tires slashed and tomatoes thrown at us. And
oh gosh.
We were going to get kicked out of these parishes for saying, here are the maps. Here's 10 years from now, 25 years from now, and 50 years from now. Louisiana has some of the most sophisticated climate data. Frankly, we don't call it that, but if you look at the appendices of the Coastal Master Plan, it's an international panel on climate change report, right?
Is that because like climate change, climate data is like a hot topic and you don't want people to like get latched on to that?
I think it's because it becomes politicized. That being said, we have lots of conversations with folks that are like, if you just don't call it climate change,
right,
we'll talk about what the effects are.
To be very frank though, that is clearly like the topic.
Sure.
But you just have to be soft-spoken about it.
But I would say in Louisiana, the effects of sea level rise are not a future scenario because of that deterioration of the Delta that has already been happening for a century. The impacts of sea level rise are more immediate. They're not 30 years from now or 40 years from now like they might be for other coastal cities. Although, you know, we also know that cities like Norfolk and Miami are not also experiencing, or Boston, not experiencing these in the future. But because of that land loss historically, we also have the opportunity to go, here's the data looking back. How have you experienced this? Here's the data we see going forward.
Right.
what do you think the effects are going to be? How do you think about your community? How do you think about your economy? Perfect. And also think about the environment as something that's tied to those things. I would also say, for some of the scariest pieces of this conversation, we had the opportunity to talk about that from a generational perspective. Mm-hmm. So 10 years from now, you might be thinking about yourself. You know, maybe you're thinking about your kids. 25 years from now, you're probably thinking about your kids or your grandkids. 50 years from now, which is when the sort of right. the 50-year planning horizon of the Coastal Master Plan, most people in the room are not thinking about themselves.
Of course.
They're thinking about their kids or their grandkids or the generations that come after them. So so what does that mean, right? And we saw residents willing to say, look, to your point, I'm never leaving, right? I'm going to die here. But my kids, they've already moved up the road or up the bayou or up the river, right? Or I want them to have a better life. And I know that this is happening. And so there's this thinking of it as immediate is a challenge, but also thinking about it as too far out is also a challenge. And well, we always have to navigate that.
This is so emotional.
Yeah, and I love
this. I'm getting emotional. I've got goosebumps.
It's this delicate balance between science, facts. There are things that are happening that you cannot prevent. How can we help that? And then you're dealing with the emotions of people and their pride. And that is such a Louisiana Southern thing, you know, and an American thing. This is my land. Yeah. This is my family. I will protect it. I will stay here. This is tried and true. Where in reality, the Delta, Louisiana, the coast is ever changing and we need to adapt to it.
Yeah.
I want to kind of move a little off subject here. We're designers, all of us here in the room. And I want to know a little bit more about example of design initiatives that we as designers can implement, whether or not we're architects or not, or we're landscape architects, or we're civil engineers. Is there something that we can do, or even homeowners that we can do to help either awareness or better design, or when it comes to land loss, when it comes to these situations?
So in Louisiana, populations, people are already moving, but let me be clear, the people with resources are moving, right? Mm-hmm. So hurricanes Katrina, Rita, Gustav, Ike, and Isaac since 2005. If you have the financial and social capacity to pick up and leave and sell your house for way less than you might have bought it for, or go move to a community where your family already is connected to, that's happening. So in the areas where we're losing population, we see other effects there. There are impacts to tax bases. There's less resources for maintenance of infrastructure, loss of social services. Groceries get shut down. Schools, in some cases, get shut down. You have to drive an hour and a half for any healthcare service, right? But then on the reverse side of that, because when people move, they have to go somewhere, there are changes happening to those receiving communities, if you will. So all of a sudden your traffic is horrendous and your schools are double capacity. But for me, the most fascinating thing here is that development exacerbates those conditions because the parishes see that growth in population and they want to encourage it because it means tax base increase and more capacity to make investments and increase in wealth. Mm-hmm. So they permit any kind of development that could possibly be put out there.
Gotcha.
So slab on grade in the floodplain, go ahead. Why not? Rental rates skyrocket. There's gentrification from those areas that in those areas that can't accommodate that growth in population. And so in the areas like St. Tammany and East Baton Rouge Parish and Tangipahoa, like you see that growth in population and the development expand out into those floodplains at an obscene rate, right? So you look back at the floods here in Louisiana, those areas that flooded were a lot of the areas that have grown since 2005.
Interesting.
And so when you combine one of the changes that we see with climate change is that the precipitation falls more heavily and more quickly in shorter intervals, and our drainage systems are not actually designed to have the capacity to respond to that quick influx of a lot of water.
Right.
You combine that with the fact that that water used to have a lot of ground to seep into, and now that's concreted over with, or is new homes as well as roads and other infrastructure. And usually developers do as little as possible to invest in those systems, as little as they're required to do. So to come back to your question for designers,
yeah,
right? Because I think the questions that you must ask are different in those conditions. We have a spectrum of challenges for communities, from those experiencing population loss all the way to those experiencing tremendous and rapid population gain. In those areas that we don't expect to be there 50 years from now, that means thinking about temporary measures. That means about architectures that maybe are designed to fail in some ways.
Interesting.
Right? And designed to maybe serve a different purpose when they're no longer there. I had a student back in 2014, the fall, when I was teaching fourth and fifth year architecture at LSU after I had returned to the States. And she was looking at the migratory patterns of birds and how many, about 5 million migratory birds pass through Louisiana. And a lot of that goes through Grand Isle, and Grand Isle is losing land at one of the most rapid rates. And she was designing architecture to create a sort of concrete terrace and habitat that was elevated long after the island was gone, right? And that's the Abby Brown, so innovative.
I got to review her, actually.
Yeah.
It was actually an awesome project.
I would never want to be reviewed by you, Seamus. You're so
I am very opinionated,
dashing.
But if I like it, I'm all in.
No, I love that concept. It's so romantic. It's like,
yeah,
you're not just thinking about this, you know, this immediate, you know, first 5, 10, 50 years. It's like,
this is an investment.
What happens to my
after?
Castle?
And no, as a student, I don't think she realized how powerful of a project it was, but it was smashing. Like,
and how fitting it is, because it's not just a fantasy. It's not just this romantic fairy tale. It's real. Like,
it's
this is something that we can
think about. I think there was a whole set of students in that 10-person studio that I had that I would have, if I could have just taken that project and let's work together to like make that a reality, it would have been amazing. That Grand Isle studio, which was funded by Louisiana Sea Grant and the Coastal Sustainability Studio, really was a design challenge. There's an opportunity to think about how you design with water, and how you think about what a section looks like and how program is distributed across that section, what it means to have facilities that could be compromised, elevated higher up. Right, we don't put the appliances on the ground level. We don't put any electrical wiring 2 feet above the floor. What does it mean to think about residential structures for that working coast? To think about the ecotourism economy that we still expect to have, even as the coast transitions. And Seamus, finally, you know, to the sort of higher ground community challenge. This is a tremendous economic opportunity, and someone's going to take advantage of
it.
For sure.
And
we need to be thinking about always stormwater management. We need to be thinking about green infrastructure and how to develop strategically and densely in those high ground areas, limited high ground areas, especially in South Louisiana that we do have. We need to be thinking about multiple purposes and multiple benefits. We need to be thinking about some of the mistakes we've made in development over the last few generations and what to not do going forward. We also need to think about the reality of displacement. And I want to be clear, coming back to that point of the people with resources or the people that are moving. Communities that have seen disinvestment or underinvestment historically, typically marginalized communities, often communities of color, and here in Louisiana, very often Black and Indigenous communities. Those communities experience a heightened and exacerbated set of effects in response to risk. When we think about those receiving communities, how do we think about affordable housing? How do we think about growth in a way that is inclusive and that connects economic development and transit opportunities to the people who need them most? And how do we think about how all of that is able to accommodate really the effects of this changing climate and the continued migration that, frankly, Louisiana is only one of the very few places in the world that is talking about it happening.
Love it. Liz for 2020 for president.
No, I don't want to be a politician. I like being exactly who I am too much. And on that note,
Liz for 2020. Honestly, I think you hit the nail on the head. Me as a designer, as an architect, James and I, here, everybody at Cicada, I think we can really take a lesson from what you were talking about. In a sense that architecture, specifically, is not about our current owners. It's about the future, right? So when even though you have an office building or a house coming in, you have to think really about long-term environmental issues and like tenants and people, because people come and go. Mm-hmm. You could have an owner that comes in and needs a building for 5 years, but in reality, someone's purchasing that property after the fact. So I think for us as designers, we really, it's up to us ethically and morally and environmentally to really design for the conditions that we live in, for those structures to be able to withstand 50, 100, 150 years. So I think that's everything that you said really inspired me as a designer. To really think about architecture in a different way.
Yeah, go get it.
For those of you who were not with us earlier, we did a little Instagram Live.
We went live.
We went live for a hot second.
We shocked Liz.
I didn't know this.
Poor Liz. She literally walked through the door. James and I were kind of, decided to go live for...
We're just going to try it out.
I was still on my walk here.
We're going to start implementing it. So anyway, we were implementing it. We're testing it out. Liz walks in and boom, we had some questions from our Instagram followers.
Right. We were crowdsourcing our questions and we had a few good ones. And you had some really great answers for them right on the spot. We did not tell her she was going to be answering these questions.
She's amazing.
She did. She crushed it.
Oh, thanks, guys.
But I think we should bring up at least one or two.
Yeah, I think one or two are pretty good. And again, you can just kind of answer these
Briefly.
You can answer these briefly. One of the questions was, if you just bought a house in New Orleans, am I insane?
I just did that, and I do feel insane.
We are actually a lot better off than a lot of other coastal cities. I mentioned earlier that I know that's shocking to everyone.
And what coastal cities are you talking about right now?
Parts of Miami or Boston or Norfolk, not everywhere, because there will be some areas that are fortified and it's worth it.
I think it's worth just mentioning that we're not here alone. Our problems
is very far reaching.
Very far reaching.
And again, lots of places, especially as we improve on our capacity to engage communities in the development of design and decision-making practices, are lots of places are looking to us. But I mentioned that most of Southern Louisiana was built by the Mississippi River over thousands of years, sure. Right. But, we arguably have the capacity with each of these river diversions to build about a square mile of land a year.
Wow.
With each of those projects. And still, the river has a lot of sediment capacity. We don't call it the mighty, muddy Mississippi for nothing. So how do we strategically use that river and think innovatively about how we shift some of our investments, whether those are industrial and economically based or whether those are more community based. Mm-hmm. Additionally, post-Katrina, we did get investment in a $14 billion levee system.
Right.
So a lot of the issues that it had before Katrina were realities of different construction techniques, different funding sources, different timelines, literally vulnerabilities in every different bend in the levee. It's shocking to look into the engineering issues there. But after Katrina, it became federally made consistent, right? And $14 billion of investment in that levee system. I don't think there's another place in the country likely to get that level of investment from the federal government without putting a much more significant sum in on the ground. So another reason why you're not that insane.
Go ahead, Jay.
Sorry, I was going to say this is a good transition, a good segue into the money side of things. So if you had an unlimited amount of money with your knowledge and power, what would you do with coastal restoration, flood mitigation, and potentially saving Louisiana
from the magic wand,
the very not climate change things that are happening?
I would invest in our community partners first and foremost, community organizations that don't see themselves as environmental. So your neighborhood association, your faith-based organization, your community organization, whatever it is that you care about, right? Maybe that's your swim team. Maybe that's your church group. Maybe whatever it is, right? Invest in those partners and provide them the opportunity to connect their own personal experience of flood risk and flooding to these larger data sets, right? And to these larger opportunities, right? Spend money to get them connected to each other. I would spend money on organizing and advocacy there. At the same time, we have $600 million a year coming every year for the next 15 years.
Ooh.
From the Deepwater Horizon settlement.
Oh.
All of that money is
money
going
for what?
Into restoration projects.
Perfect.
Which is great. But none of that money is currently staying here in Louisiana, or not enough of it.
Wait, right? Why?
Because we're not necessarily requiring contracting practices that require prime contractors, maybe even if they have to be global institutions, to hire local subs who hire local people.
Mm.
So how do we invest in a way that connects the people who need jobs here in Louisiana to those amazing economic opportunities? I don't think we've ever in the history of Louisiana had such a sustainable funding source that we know that money is coming on this day of this month,
right?
Every year,
right?
Right. How do we leverage that? So
wow,
I would put a little bit of catalytic money into that. I would invest in.
So we were asking the silly question, but this money exists.
Oh yeah,
no, it's insane.
I mean, it's not enough, right? Well, like it's not enough, but it's a big down payment.
But I love it.
Yeah,
I love your answer though. Is that really bringing the community together? We
don't
talk to one another.
Y'all, right? Our destinies are tied together.
Yeah,
and this is not a time or a space to be timid.
I want to ask you, so you grew up both in New Orleans and in Memphis. You are making change in powerful movement in the coastal resilience sector. What is the advice that you would give yourself, whether it's as a kid or going through architecture school or even in London?
Follow your intuition. Learn a set of rules, right? How those each sort of game or system operates, and then find a way to understand and critique yourself, but also live by that sort of gut intuition and improvisation and drive.
Well, your drive is clear. We could definitely see that. And it's, you know, we're very happy to have you here.
It's contagious.
I hope one day people run into you at a pub and they say like, oh, I found Liz and she was amazing.
I'm going to be the bartender again. Just give me a second.
Perfect. Perfect. But yeah, it's been great having you, and I hope that our listeners, you know, look up some of the things we've talked about, some of the books, the websites. There are ways to make Louisiana a better and wonderful place, even though it already is.
Yeah,
there's always room for improvement. We are not just mush, even though we stand on mush.
We float on mush.
We float, and thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right. And folks, that's going to do it for this week's episode. I am Seamus.
And I'm James.
And we would like to thank our sponsors, Brew Caray and PJ's Coffee.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram @TheSwarm and drop us a review on iTunes.
Stay tuned for our next episode.